not all content is created equal, right? So we like to say, oh, 1 hour a day of screen time for every kid. Well, we should also be thoughtful about what that hour is. There's a big difference between professionally produced, long form educational content, think Sesame Street, Dora Explorer, and YouTube Kids, which is just full of user generated content designed to engage you. Short. So snacks, you know, it's like Halloween. Here's a pile of candy, you know, have what you want whenever you want for as long as you want, you know. Thank God we only do that once a year, right?
Hi, this is Danae. I'm the founder of Simple Families. Simple Families is an online community for parents who are seeking a simpler, more intentional life. In this show, we focus on minimalism with kids, positive parenting, family wellness, and decreasing the mental load. My perspectives are based in my firsthand experience raising kids, but also rooted in my PhD in child development. So you're going to hear conversations that are based in research, but more importantly, real life. Thanks for joining us.
That voice you heard in the intro is Dr. Carl Marcy.
Dr. Marcy is a leader in the fields of social and consumer neuroscience. He's on faculty at Harvard Medical School and is a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also the author of Rewired, Protecting Your Brain in the Digital Age. Many of you who have been listening to the podcast for some time know that I have been on a mission to better understand and find a better balance when it comes to my own use of technology, and also on behalf of my kids. Dr. Marcy's book was filled with fascinating research. I learned so much through my conversation with him. In our conversation today, we're talking about the impact that a digital life has on our brains and the brains of the developing child. And it's conversations and books like this that make me feel a little bit afraid, but also empower me to stay strong in my values and strength to carry on in this journey to find a better balance or some semblance of balance when it comes to media in our lives. I hope you enjoy this conversation today. Thanks for tuning in. Hi, Carl. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me on the show today. Tell us first a little bit about your career and how you came to writing this book, Rewired.
Sure. I describe myself as a physician, scientist, entrepreneur, and author, which means I have ADHD and I get bored easily. But I've been very fortunate to have a rich career. I started off as an academic after I finished my residency training in adult psychiatry. So I was a professor at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, and I was studying the neurobiology of empathy, how one brain understands another brain. And I got inspired to do that while I was doing my training in psychotherapy and thinking, how does just sitting with someone once or twice a week actually make them better? And if you look at the effect size, how much people get better, you know, it's about as powerful as Prozac. And we didn't really understand how that was possible because we didn't understand the brain science and we didn't understand psychotherapy process the way we do, I think, today. So that set me off on a journey to measure people's emotional response and empathy responses. And that led me to the MIT Media Lab, where they were building some interesting technologies, which I'm happy to tell you about.
Wow. So that actually makes me think of one really interesting thing that I've been reflecting on recently was post-pandemic, since I've gone back to an in-person therapy practice, I'm probably maybe 15 hours a week face-to-face with people in my office with zero technology. And I think it has had such a good impact on my well-being, just all that increased human connection time. And it's one of those things you don't think about, right? Like kind of the after effect of it.
Well, I love that. I will tell you, when I got to MIT, they were building the first generation of what we now call wearables. So they were taking handheld computers and doing what MIT engineers do, taking them apart and plugging in heart rate sensors, skin conductance sensors, Bluetooth sensors, voice sensors, you name it, and literally sewing it into a vest and walking around. And I was like, oh my gosh, you have a portable, wearable, multi-sensing platform. They're like, yeah, it's great. We don't know what to do with it. I said, well, I have some ideas. And this is what sort of set me off on this journey, where we started to measure audience responses to marketing and media stimuli. And to your point about face-to-face interactions, I always used to tell my employees and clients, I mean, we would measure everything from full-length feature films in a movie to television shows to five-second commercials using very sophisticated technologies. And you know what the two most emotionally stimulating moments of every study was? It was the beginning and the end when our study staff went in to talk to the respondents. It was not the stimuli. It's human face-to-face interaction that really gets our emotions going. And you just described it incredibly well. You know, we're having a lovely conversation now via Zoom. And if I were to measure our emotion responses, there would be moments when we're in sync and moments mm-hmm. when we're out of sync. And that's normal for any social interaction that's sort of face-to-face. But if we were to do the same interaction together in a room, you would just increase the level of arousal 2, 3, 4-fold. And that's the way we were wired and evolved for like a million years. So
you're saying Zoom isn't as good as in-person connection.
I think there's some data to support that. Yes.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I think about with that is media multitasking, which you talk a lot about in your book. And when I'm on Zoom, I'm much more likely to have my cell phone next to me, to have another browser window open that might be alerting me, right? And I know that's the same for the clients that I see on Zoom too, is that they're not 100% like they would be if they were sitting in my office. So what is that?
How could they be, right? I mean, you're sitting in front of, you know, in some cases, the incredibly powerful devices, you know, that have orders of magnitude higher computational power than the computers that put man on the moon. And they have tons of applications that are constantly giving alerts. So it's just, it's what in the book I call divided attention, right? So the mere presence of a computer or a smartphone while we're having a social interaction literally divides our attention to the point where that interaction changes. So I cite studies where you can have face-to-face conversations with a smartphone on the table, upside down, off, and it's not even your phone. It's just a dummy phone. And it alters the course of the conversation when you don't have it. Same thing is true for productivity, right? One of my favorite studies in the book looked at undergraduates taking a hard math test. And there were three conditions. One condition was leave your phone outside the room. Another condition was, you know, turn it off and put it under your chair. And the third condition was turn it off and leave it on the table. And the results were a step function. The closer that phone was to the person and their proximity, the worse their scores were. So, yeah. You know,
it was like 30% less, wasn't it, that the people who had the phone in front of them? I share that study with almost every tween and teen that I work with because I think it's incredible. And something that I'm noticing with this age range too is that there's a difference. So the kids who have a very high connection to their phone have a hard time letting it go. Some of the parents will put downtime on their phone mm-hmm. and some parents take their phone mm-hmm. and you would think those would be the same, but they're not, right? So
how have you noticed their difference?
So most of the kids really need to have their phone with them. Even if it's on downtime, that's okay. Just don't take it away from me. I need to have that physical connection to the device to feel calm. Right. It's a different debate, whether you lock it in a box, take it, or you have it shut down in front of you.
So which one do you think is better? And then I'll tell you why.
Oh, definitely completely removing it from sight, locking it up in a lockbox, whatever you
do. Yeah, I agree. And it's harder for mm-hmm. all the reasons you just articulated. But this is what I describe in the book as media as a mood regulator. And I think, you know, among the research we did at Interscope, which was the company that I co-founded that was measuring audience response in at pioneers in the field of consumer neuroscience, right? I think the major contribution to the literature was this idea of media as a mood regulator. And we kind of stumbled on it. We were literally monitoring people in their homes. We had like a spy camera so we could see what they were seeing. This is all voluntary. And then they had heart rate and skin conductance monitors on. And they were told to just go about their day. And we had hundreds of hours of this, and we had human coders review them and look at it. And we noticed a couple things. One was there was an awful lot of visual attention shifting from one media platform to another. So watching TV, reading a magazine, or watching TV, looking at your smartphone, or listening to the radio and doing something else. And this is what we started to measure this and created a media attention span. And noticed that young people had a shorter attention span when it comes to media multitasking than adults did. That was finding number one. But finding number two was the reason you switched from one to the other is when your emotion went down a little bit. And then later in the lab, what we saw when people were just watching TV with their phones is, you know, not surprisingly, we watched television for the entertainment content, not the advertising. So the advertising comes on and everyone picks up their phone because your emotions drop. And then sometimes during the show, the emotions drop. And so we've learned, adults and worrisomely children, the earlier you do this, to just use our smartphones as a mood regulator, as an emotion regulator. It becomes almost like a technological pacifier, which is unfortunate.
So, you know, what do you mean when you say the emotions drop? Like when you get slightly bored or?
Well, let's talk about emotion for a second, right? So there are lots of different models of emotion, but I think the most commonly accepted and easiest one for your audience to understand is a two-dimensional model where you have arousal on one axis, so low to high, and then you have valence, or is it positive or negative, on another axis. So things can be high arousing and positive, like, oh, it's great to see you and meet you. Or it could be low arousal and negative. Well, I'm really sad, right? So those are the two dimensions. We were measuring with our technology primarily the arousal axis, how high intensity versus low intensity. So when I say drop, your emotions would drop in intensity. And what happens is people like to be aroused, right? We like the stimulus, the titillation. And we know the reward systems, when they fire, there's also a burst of arousal. So lots of things can increase our emotional intensity. But if you want to guarantee it, just pick up your smartphone and go flipping through TikTok, right, or social media. Something's going to get you that yeah, little dopamine release. And that's what I mean by emotional arousal and regulation.
So a year ago, I did a deep dive into my own technology use. And one of the things that I noticed I was doing—
How'd that
was
go?
Actually really good. I ended up pretty much entirely stepping away from social media. I was spending, it's like embarrassing to admit online, but I was spending about 27 hours a week online on social media.
And almost a full-time job.
I have reclaimed my life, basically, by stepping away, like a whole day. It's been incredible in so many ways.
How did you step away? Did you have to do it sort of slowly, or did you do the full-on pick a date? I'm gonna do this.
Well, I was noticing, well, because I was mostly running my business online and I was using social media as a platform to help run my business, to run Simple Families. And I had to make the decision that I had to change my business model entirely. And then I unfollowed everyone on Instagram. So I no longer had a feed and I no longer posted. So I no longer had direct messages. So basically I wasn't getting any input. So I still have my account, but I don't have anything to view and I don't have anything to interact on. So it's been just a huge cutback that actually went pretty well.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, well, one of the things that I associate to you when I hear you describe, by the way, a beautiful example of how to manage social media, well done, is that we know from a reward system perspective, right? This is at a simple level, the dopamine high that we all chase in life. And there's lots of ways we can get that high. But we know from other studies that the number of likes actually correlates with the amount of reward activity in our brain, right? And so you were being rewarded every time you got that feedback and said, you know what, to the extent that that's actually driving my behaviors, and we know that the reward system drives our habits and our behaviors, I need to turn that off and kind of find other ways to get natural rewards through family and connections and social interactions. And I'm sure, you know, all the ways you now enrich your life with those 27 or 30 hours a week.
Right. Yeah. Sleep.
Sleep is a good one. Well, we could talk about sleep in the brain too.
One of the things that I noticed about myself that is really interesting, and I'm sure there's other parents that do this too, is I noticed every time my kids argue, I would reach for my phone. It was a reflex. Like they would argue and I would reach, and it felt like a numbing out kind of thing.
Yeah. Some people take a drink of wine. Some people go to social media. So, you know, look, I have kids, you have kids, they can be challenging to manage and stimulate a lot of emotions in us from our own childhood. Again, great example. Media as a mood regulator. I'm upset. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to intervene here. I'm going to go escape to something that will distract me, but also feel good.
Right. and not necessarily help the situation, but in the moment, not, right? Bring relief.
Correct.
So you start your book off with the quote, "The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is now." Mm-hmm. Can you tell me why you picked that?
Yeah, because I think that we are behind the curve as a society, as humanity. I've been spending a lot of time thinking about and beginning to write about ChatGPT and these large language models. And I've been stunned by the equal parts enthusiasm from the people who are developing them and how it's going to change the world. And this is the best invention humanity's ever seen. You know, they're comparing it to the discovery of fire, to give you an example. Oh yeah. No, and these are sober, serious people.
Wow.
On the one hand. On the other hand, you know, there's another group sort of saying time out. Like literally there was I think published yesterday or the day before, a letter from a group of people who were informed on this, signed by many, many people, saying we need a technology timeout. We are not prepared as a species to handle this technology. Why? Well, you know, I would argue because we're a little behind on the smartphone in our pocket, which, you know, by the way, these large language models are going to make that technology look, you know, trivial. When we can interact with a computer that will trick us into thinking we are having the type of interaction you and I are having right now, but not actually have a human on the other side and have it trained on a source of information that's equal parts good information or truth and misinformation, we're going to have a problem. And as a psychiatrist, what I worry about, and I literally this morning just wrote about what I think may be the first reported case of this, you know, you're depressed, feeling a little suicidal, you start talking to the computer and it screws up and gives you recommendations on how to kill yourself and you kill yourself, right? That's a tragedy and that's going to set us back. And we have no guardrails to prevent that. So that's what I mean by we're a little behind the eight ball. I think we look, you see the statistics, right? Rates of just about every major mental illness, depression, anxiety, PTSD, substance use, suicide are going up, up, up and accelerated through the pandemic. You know, that's not good news. Something's going on, and it's not just technology. There's other issues. We had a little pandemic, 100-year event, that was very disruptive. And there's, you know, there's a lot of concerns about climate change and the economy. But I think, you know, as we're discussing here, we've got to do a better job with our relationship with technology.
Yeah. So I'm going to tell you a story about my 7-year-old. So she is not one who is really attracted to screens in general, I would say. This is of no doing of my own. My 9-year-old is very much attracted to screens, but she's a kid who, you know, she'll come home from school. She won't even ask to turn on the TV. She'll go play. She'll do her thing. So she was exposed to Minecraft at school in their technology class and played. They would probably play for 10 minutes once a week. And she came home and she had asked, this was like on a Monday, like, can I download Minecraft? And I said, yeah, I guess so. They don't have a ton of iPad time, but I felt like Minecraft was probably a pretty simple app, right?
Like, seems like a reasonable request.
A lot of educational benefits, or so I hear. Mm-hmm. So she played one day after school for about an hour, and I asked her to turn it off, and she had a hard time turning it off. She got upset. Mm-hmm. The next day she came home from school, the first thing that she asked for was her iPad so she could play Minecraft. The second day, I asked her to turn it off after about 45 minutes, and she cried, tears, screamed, upset. And as she was marching up the stairs, this kid who's never acted like this around technology before, all I could think was, I feel like I gave her cocaine. Like she had just this very short, brief introduction and had such an extreme reaction to letting it go. And so why, you know, if we're seeing these kind of reactions to stepping away from technology, why aren't we really calling this addiction? I feel like so many experts are reluctant to, not to say that my daughter was addicted to Minecraft after 2 days. That's not my point here. It was that I saw this extreme response to a type of addictive technology. So why are we afraid of calling technology addictive? Or
yeah, it's a good question. I go out of my way in the book to spend a fair amount of time talking about the difference between habits and addiction. I think the short answer to the question is if we label it addiction, it means everything and nothing at all. And it doesn't really separate who's at risk. And now what's lovely about your story and arguably tragic about your story is that here's a child who's temperamentally not attracted to screens. And you know, as you were talking, I was like, oh, okay, this might be the type of child who's a little easier to navigate through this stuff. But then
so we thought, right?
Like, you know, then she gets Minecraft and she goes crazy. Look, I mean, again, as a psychiatrist, like you sort of learn, like there are people who are into alcohol, there are people who are into heroin and pills, and there are people who are into cocaine. Like these are very powerful substances that work very differently in the brain, you know, gambling. And, you know, there's lots of people who take painkillers after surgery and have no problem getting off of them. But then there's a subset who take painkillers after surgery and can never get off of them. And that's where I think we need to go as a mental health field in this topic, is to identify who's at risk for what, right? And get a whole lot smarter and get a whole lot more research dollars into understanding those risk factors, so that you can say to your daughter, you know, guess what? You know, we now know you're sort of attracted to building environments online, and we need to recognize that. And maybe your son's into video games, right? Which is not uncommon, by the way. So, then, you know, the conversation with her has to be, look, we're going to do this, but you have to realize this is going to have a powerful impact on you. And mommy is worried about you if you play too much, but we know, look, and I'm becoming, you know, I'm starting to sound like my mom, you know, everything in moderation, right? Yeah. So how do we find a moderate amount of Minecraft, right? And that might be a little different for your daughter and my daughter, to be honest, who just has zero interest in Minecraft. While my boys, it's all they talked about until they found the next thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we had a similar experience with YouTube Kids a year ago, with a brief foray into being able to access it openly, and then the same kind of reaction. But it's only been those two things very specifically, which, I mean, I feel like they do have a lot in common. So,
well, they do and they don't. I mean, as you know, I had the same experience as YouTube Kids with my oldest, and I wrote about that in the book, and I was surprised at his tantrum. I mean, this is full on, by far the worst tantrum I ever had, after, just like you, first time, 1 hour, YouTube Kids. I even paid for Red, so there's no advertising. And you know, he became so emotionally dysregulated, otherwise known as a tantrum, after that experience pulling him off. I thought, well, maybe he's sick or hungry or, you know, just having a bad day. But then when it happened again and again, I was like, something's going on, right? And this is what I talk about a bit in the book. You know, not all content is created equal, right? So we like to say, oh, 1 hour a day of screen time for every kid. Well, we should also be thoughtful about what that hour is. There's a big difference between professionally produced long form educational content, think Sesame Street, Dora Explorer, and YouTube Kids, which is just full of user generated content designed to engage you, short. So snacks, you know, it's like Halloween. Here's a pile of candy, you know, have what you want whenever you want for as long as you want, you know. Thank God we only do that once a year, right?
Right. Yeah. I love that you called it snackable forms of content, because that, I think that really equates to TikTok, you know, YouTube Shorts, Reels on Instagram, and that, and, you know, I will say that Instagram Reels was one of the things that really pushed me off social media, was once that came out and the feeling that gave me engaging in those. And I've never been on TikTok. I imagine it's very similar. But that it's a different form of content. And also the fact that so many content creators were essentially like taking a PhD and trying to put it into a 1 minute reel and teach through this. And
well, and there's so many examples out there to learn from, and everyone is accelerating. You know, look, you're a very sophisticated thinker on this topic. I presume your audience is as well. But let's break down for a minute the difference between sitting in front of a large screen with an hour of professionally produced content. Again, I like to use Sesame Street because it really is the first one where they got professionals into the room working with writers and producers and great actors to produce content that was designed to be educational, right? And it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has clear educational goals. And my kid watches that, you know, they're like, oh, that was nice. And they take away something, versus sitting in front of a small screen where they have complete control. Right. So as soon as they have that little dip, remember we were talking about arousal, right, earlier? Well, if you watch an audience watching an hour of television or a full length feature film, right, you know, film producers and television producers, they know how to tell stories. And to really get that payoff at the end, that big emotional high, you got to go through some emotional lows, right? And so one of the things we found with young people is they don't tolerate low intensity emotions at all because they've never had to. And that's what, honestly, I worry the most about. It's a subtle thing. It's hard to explain to people. But if you spend your life going on, you're going to fry your prefrontal cortex. You're going to not have much emotional ability to control your own emotions. You're going to be more prone to addiction. You're going to have a shorter attention span. You're going to be more prone to ADHD. And your productivity is going to go down. And you're setting yourself up for a life of challenges.
That was heavy, Carl.
I'm sorry. I mean, I honestly hate to be heavy. I mean, I really
No.
And I'll be honest, as I was writing the book, I was like, no, it can't be that bad, right? It can't really be that bad. Yeah, but guess what? But the pandemic made it worse.
Yeah.
Honestly, like going into this pre-pandemic, I was like, all right, I'm gonna write this book and I'm gonna spend a lot of time talking to you, educating you and your audience. Now I was like, oh no, I get it, it's bad. And they have their own examples and they go quickly to what do we do? And you know, yeah, that's important too.
We're going to pause for a 2-minute word from today's sponsors. The first sponsor for today is Fast Growing Trees. Anything from shade to fresh fruit to privacy and natural beauty, fastgrowingtrees.com can help you plant your dream garden with their expert advice and fast, reliable shipping. Not only do they have things for outdoors, but I recently ordered some indoor houseplants as well. And although I'm not the best at keeping houseplants alive, Fast Growing Trees come with a 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee. And you can even purchase a 1-year warranty, which I did for my plants because I need it. FastGrowingTrees.com's plant experts curate thousands of easy-to-grow plant, shrub, and tree varieties for your unique climate. Meyer lemons to evergreens and everything in between. Join over 1.5 million happy Fast Growing Trees customers. Go to fastgrowingtrees.com/simple now to get 15% off your entire order. Get 15% off your entire order at fastgrowingtrees.com/simple. Our second sponsor for today is Just Thrive. Let's face it, stress sucks, especially when it seems to run your life, keeping you on edge and refusing to let you relax or unwind. But there's good news. You can beat stress before it beats you. Just Thrive, Probiotic, and Just Calm are here to help you reclaim your health, your happiness, and your peace of mind. Not only will Just Thrive Probiotic help you to stay ahead of things like gas and bloating and constipation, when your gut is balanced and healthy, you'll be able to handle stress like a boss. The best part is you can test drive Just Thrive Probiotic and Just Calm risk-free. They have a lifetime money-back guarantee, so what do you have to lose? Right now, when you go to justthrive.com and use the promo code SIMPLE, you can get 20% off a 90-day bottle of Just Thrive Probiotic and Just Calm. That's like getting a month for free. I decided to try Just Thrive after my conversation with the founder, Tina Anderson, which you might have heard on the podcast recently. So check it out. Go to justthrivehealth.com and use the promo code SIMPLE. You can get 20% off a 90-day bottle of Just Thrive Probiotic and Just Calm. That's justthrivehealth.com and promo code SIMPLE. Thanks so much for tuning in and supporting our sponsors. Back to today's episode.
You know, I mean, for me, reading your book, also Stolen Focus by Johan Hari and Dopamine Nation by Anna Lemke, these three books, I feel like, have really given me the conviction that I need to help give my kids the guidance that they need, because there's so much social pressure and so much kid pressure, right? Like, how many times a day do I get, hey, can I watch this? Hey, can I have my iPad? Hey, can I have this? And as a parent, it's exhausting. It is so exhausting. Yeah. And when you look around and everybody else is doing it, I think I at least need that renewed energy and conviction that I have gotten through, especially your book and these other books, to know the importance of holding strong and holding my values on this. And I think it's important for other parents to hear that too.
Yeah, no, I love that point. But we shouldn't have to do it alone, right? It's too hard to do alone, right? Everyone should be talking about this. We need to have a common expectation among parents and educators and politicians and everybody that we want a relationship with technology that is proactive, meaning we plan for it and use it, that empowers, right? That this actually does what, by the way, these technologies are fabulous at making us more productive and entertaining us. I mean, I'm not, you know, I use my smartphone and iPad and all that stuff too, right? And I'm constantly trying to pay attention to my own use patterns. But we need to do this together. Mm-hmm. I give the example all the time, right? We don't let our children drive a car until they're 16 years old. They have to pass a test, right? They have a chaperone for several months afterward, right? There's all kinds of rules. And even then, right, the insurance companies, you know, charge a premium until you're in your mid-20s, right? Because the actuarials at car insurance companies knew the neurobiology of the brain before the neuroscientists did, right? They, mm-hmm. The rates of car insurance don't actually start to come down until the brain fully matures in your mid-20s. Yeah. Right, which I always found kind of interesting. But we have to protect this precious thing called the brain for everyone.
So tell me how it's gone trying to have conversations like this with people in your social circle that are not necessarily coworkers. So like friends of your kids, parents of your kids' friends. Has that been difficult? How's it been received? No,
actually, I think it's been received quite well. Look, okay. I'm very sort of privileged to live in Boston, and my kids go to good schools, and the parents are very focused on education. And, you know, people actually are pretty good about this topic. You know, we have conversations, you know, like you just did, like, what are these tantrums? And, you know, when do I give a phone? Yeah, we're just emailing a couple weeks ago with a close friend whose, you know, daughter's a little older than mine. And he's got him on a phone. He's like, how do I lock this down? Right. I was like, ooh, that's a good question. Right. I need to write a blog. No, I have another friend who happens to be the head of IT of a very big private equity firm. I was like, he'll know because he's already done this. And he sent me like this 3-page document, and it's complicated. And I was like, oh my goodness, like, how do we translate, you know, all this? Like, this is what you have to do to protect your children. You know, these technology companies have to do a better job. What I worry about is the new sort of gap between, you know, those who have and have not. So I think the new digital divide isn't access to the internet or smartphone technologies. It's access to, you know, information and education and really good childcare. I mean, if you think about it, so many people are using these smartphones as essentially childcare or pacifier. And I watch people at airports and traveling, and I just want to sit down and say, can we have a conversation? Like, this is, I get it. You're traveling and it's really hard and all that. It's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah. I saw a bassinet stroller at the airport with what looked like probably an infant that couldn't even sit up. Last time I was there with an iPad in there.
And as you know, in the book, I write about baby Einstein, right? It's an mm-hmm. amazing story, right? I think it was the late 90s. This mom has her first child and she's excited about educating her, borrows her husband's video camera, makes some hand puppets and puts some music behind it and shows it to her, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 month old daughter, and she's in rapture, and baby Einstein is born. And this becomes, you know, I mean, I grew up in that era. You know, there was a time in which 2 out of 3 households with a child under 3 years old had at least one of these DVDs, you know, winning awards. Disney buys the company, another great educational tool in our arsenal to help families, right? And then 2007, research comes out, shows that not only are kids who are watching baby Einstein not progressing at the same rate, they're falling behind. And this leads to research showing what's called the video transfer deficit, right? So up until around age 2 or 3, children literally lack the neural scaffolding to take information from a 2-dimensional screen into the real world. And so while they look like they're paying attention, they are, and they are in a kind of rapture, they're really displacing the kinds of interactions that they actually need. Now, I felt like when I read that and wrote about that, I was like, oh, good. You know, at least there's one thing that we've solved. Guess what? I went on Amazon a few months ago. You could buy baby Einstein. I was like, wait, how'd this happen? People are literally repackaging it, reselling it. And there's reviews, 4 out of 5 stars. My baby loves this. This is great. I was like, how is this?
Probably better than CoComelon. Is that, how do you pronounce it? Do you know CoComelon, or is it
CoComelon? CoComelon. Yeah, no, CoComelon. I think that's, that's another one.
That's rapid cycling, like every 10 seconds changing images.
Up until age 3, nothing. The only screen these kids should be on is, you know, video chat And that's with the grandparents or mom and dad who are traveling or occasionally a friend. Full stop. Because any other interaction with a screen up until around age three, American Academy of Pediatrics says two, I say three because I think two is still too young, is going to displace other activities that they need.
So I limited my kids a lot in those early toddler years. And I remember having a family member say to me, you know, you can control all of that now, but what happens when they go to a friend's and they watch it at a friend's or they do this at a friend's, right? Sort of implying what's the use of limiting it in the early years if they're just going to end up doing it anyways. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's an excellent point because I feel the same way. Like we were pretty good, right? I was writing this book and we set limits on our kids, but they go to school with kids whose parents aren't as disciplined. And so they're exposed to vocabulary and ideas and things that are far beyond their age. And there really is not a lot we can do about it. That said, you know, I think an answer to the specific question is, well, you know what, if you send your kid to school with another family and they don't stop at streetlights and cross the road aggressively, right? You would worry in that moment that they would be at risk, right? And so if we think of risks as compounding over time, right, the more we expose our children to risk, the more chances they have of having a bad outcome. So you still want to control and try to educate and regulate and modulate use when you can, because we know, and I think the book is very clear about this, that more exposure is worse than less. And if you just look at the one study that looked at the time spent in front of the screen up until I believe it was age three, every hour per day a child spends increased the risk of ADHD at age seven by 10%. It's a huge number.
Yeah. What do you think about adult onset ADHD? I've been hearing a lot more about that.
Well, it's a controversial thing. I think a couple of things. One, you know, we have much more awareness of ADHD as a society, as mental health professionals. So I think people are paying more attention to it. So yes, I'm sure that there's a group of people who probably struggled their whole lives with a form of ADHD that was just sort of quiet and they were able to compensate. And then life, you know, happens and gets hard and it becomes more symptomatic as adults. That's really just ADHD that was there and gets diagnosed late. In terms of onset, like someone who clearly did not have ADHD and then it happened, that's unlikely to happen neurobiologically by itself, right? There, you know, we know ADHD has a genetic component and environmental component and needs the seeds for that are set early on. So if someone's having a truly adult onset ADHD that wasn't there before, you have to look for what else is going on in their brain, whether it's substance use, addiction to anything online, shopping, video games, pornography, you know, social media, or, you know, something organic, right? Do they have a small brain tumor? You know, I have a dear friend who's struggling a bit, and we're trying to figure out how much of this is, you know, anxiety, depression, and how much of it is maybe long COVID, mm-hmm. right? You know, because he's got some symptoms that just don't make sense for pure depression. And he's got ADHD and he's having trouble functioning. And these things are hard to tease apart.
Yeah. So I find myself worrying that we're kind of as the kids who are growing up with tablets, as they're getting to be of the age where they have more say in how they spend their time. Mm-hmm. I feel like there are the kids who go really big into sports and are doing sports most days of the week. And they're really getting their dopamine that way from the mm-hmm. exercise. And then there's the kids who are coming home from school and spending many hours on screens. And like, I think in the past, there's always been sort of a middle group in there where kids who are, you know, they're doing art or they're playing instruments, they're doing kind of lower stimulation activities or hobbies. I worry that that is being lost because those lower stimulation activities aren't as, they're not as, I don't know, stimulating as the screens. Is there any research that supports that?
Not that I'm aware of, but if you think about competing with learning an instrument, how much effort that requires,
right.
and what behavioral psychologists call the reward schedule, right? It, you know, when you're learning to play a piano or a guitar or anything, you know, that moment when your fingers do what they're supposed to do, and you make music for the first time, or you challenge yourself and conquer a more complex piece, that's when you get that dopamine release. Mm-hmm. And that takes time and effort. Now, you know, we all know that's called learning, right?
Yeah.
And the problem with these screens is they don't require learning. It's entertainment for the most part. And that's what we have to separate. We have to separate learning from entertainment, and get kids to understand that. You know, my kids aren't super into sports yet, and I'm hoping maybe they will. It's just harder these days, right? Because they can't go out in the backyard and play like the way I did growing up. But you know, fortunately, we have a piano, and you know, mom is a very gifted pianist, and one of my oldest son is taking to it. And I sit there and I watch him play and I listen to him play. I'm like, you know, thank God he's got something, right, that he gets excited about that isn't on a screen.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that's it too. Part of, you know, exploring and finding different things that light your kids up. And some kids, I do think we have to first scale back on the screens before they even are able to open up to those other things. What do you think?
Absolutely. And you know, I make a bunch of recommendations in the book, but on this topic, I think with kids, you got to get them outside in nature. Right. You know, because we know that that's good for the brain. It's rewarding. You can explore. Ideally, it's with some friends or family members. They can have that social connection too. You know, nobody goes for a nature walk with a friend or family member and feels worse after. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, I say that to my patients too, trying to motivate them to exercise. Right. Oh, yeah, it's going to take a lot of time and it takes effort and things like that. But have you ever talked to anyone after a good workout who said, you know, that was a complete waste of time? No, they don't. Right. We don't say that because we right. need to exercise, and our brain needs it too. So I think I love your point. I think we all as parents have to really be creative about the types of things we expose our kids to. And try to think of ways to get them to engage in the world that don't require technology.
Yeah. Something I've started with my kids is that I will pause after an activity and ask them to reflect. And I'll just say, how do you feel? Like if my son went outside to shoot hoops, and when he's done, I'll be like, how do you feel? Last night at every night in the past few months, I've been letting them each watch one YouTube video start to finish, and I'm supervising. So we'll sit at the end of the night and I'll let her pick one. I'll let him pick one. And no skipping around, though. The rule is like, when you pick it, you got to start it, you got to finish it.
Good for you. Yeah.
And invariably every night it's, can I have another one? And so yeah. Then I'll say, okay, it's over. How do you feel? Right. And you feel a little angry. You feel a little irritable, and just trying to get them to make that pause and that connection with how do you feel afterwards? And so often when you have that, as you called it in your book, you don't have the transitional, those end points, like with YouTube, there's no end, it just keeps right. going, that you don't have that pause with technology.
Yeah. And that's, you know, the doom scrolling and the autoplay, right? You know, these are amazing tricks that companies have figured out to keep us doing the thing that they get paid for, which is watching more. And this is what I always tell parents. I mean, you got to realize everything, just about everything online is designed to do one thing, keep you there. Right. That's the metric they all get paid on. And so these are big, big companies with big, big budgets and huge motivation to reel your child in. And you just need to be aware of that. I love also trying to give kids an emotion vocabulary and create awareness. That's key. Really, really important for them to sort of pause and sort of reflect and say, like, how do I feel? And I want to do that again. Or I feel calm. Right. You know, I worry about anxiety as much as ADHD and depression. These kids feel so anxious to me. And that's because, again, they're used to regulating their emotion with technology. It's hard for them to sit still. I mean, there's that study towards the end of the book where, you know, they took young people and literally asked them, if you had a choice between giving up your smartphone for, I don't know, 6 months or having your non-dominant hand cut off, what would you do? And people are like,
I don't want to know.
Oh yeah, that a huge resentment did. And there's another one where they literally had people sit for, I think it was like 12 minutes quietly with a button that they can press to give themselves a shock. And, you know, as the significant parts of people, they just couldn't do it. They'd rather just give themselves a shock because they couldn't sit with themselves for 12 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy. You know, this is why I recommend meditation, too, because it teaches us to just, you know, whether that's yoga or Tai Chi or you know, different types of meditation. There's something for everybody in that genre, just like there's a sport for everyone. But really, you know, teaching ourselves to be with ourselves, get our brains in what's called the default mode network, right? And really try to soothe ourselves. We know that the brain changes in ways that are very positive and helpful when it comes to attention, emotion regulation, and social interaction. Look, if I told you that I could make you and your kids have better attention, better social interactions, and be more productive in life, wouldn't you want that? Right? Who wouldn't want, you know, yes, I'll take that. Well, guess what? Managing your relationship with technology will give you all that.
Mm. So I'm getting trained in neurofeedback. I want to hear your honest thoughts on neurofeedback.
Oh, I mean, I think depending on the interface and what the goal is and what you're actually doing, there's no question it can be helpful. I mean, again, it's really a type of meditation with some feedback. So I think I'm all for it. I think some of them overpromise and underdeliver, right? So you got to be careful because there's lots of that out there. But I encourage anything that allows us to reflect. It's also a great example of how you can use technology in service of your brain, right?
Yeah.
There's ways in which, you know, long form educational content has been shown to correlate with kids doing better, right? So Sesame Street turns out to be a positive thing, right? But yeah, you're still sitting in front of the screen. So again, we've got to be careful not to just, you know, villainize all screen time. It's really a function of what we're doing. And one other point on that, which I loved what you said earlier with the one YouTube video a night, is that you sit with them, right? So if you look at the video game literature, for example, and you could tell in the book, I kind of dance around video games a little bit and I sprinkle them throughout. Certainly in the addiction section, I talk about video games, but I had a whole section on video games that the editor cut because it was too long and complex. But one of the major findings that I took away from that literature review is that when kids play video games, boys in particular, because they tend to be more common in boys, with a friend in the room, they have much better outcomes than sort of sitting alone downstairs. It becomes social. When kids are watching content with you there or me there, it's a very different, you know, we can point out, oh, that was funny. Oh, that you reinforce that. You could talk about things. It becomes social. And you know,
connecting.
And yeah, exactly. And fun. Like, you know, I used to talk about, you know, when I used to give talks for this consumer research company, you know, sometimes there'd be some young people and they'd be like, you know, Dr. Marcy, you keep talking about television. Like, what is that? They didn't even know what television is. I was like, oh my God, I had to explain, you know, scheduled television, right? So, you know, shows happen at a regular schedule. They were put over the airways through, you know, antenna and then it was through a cable. And, you know, I couldn't go to school Friday morning without watching, you know, Friends and the Cosby Show or I'd be shunned. And it became a very social event. There was one screen. It was in the living room. People gathered together. And oddly, you know, that form of television actually brought people and society together in a way that all this fragmented experiences doesn't.
Yeah. And you're right. Thinking about that, like I was in the TGIF era, right? Where it was like Fresh Prince, Step by Step, Hang with Mr. Cooper, whatever the, I can't believe
you're a bit younger than me.
So, but we would talk about it at school, right? Mm-hmm. And with friends. And so we had that, you know, media became a way of connecting and a common element. And now maybe kids occasionally have that with a new movie, but because every kid is kind of so deep in their own piece, I think it's hard, right? Because everyone, the interests are so broad and everyone's going so deep in their own interest area that those shared interests are fewer.
That's exactly right. They're having their own experience on their own timeline. You're binge watching, you know, something on a Sunday, you know, everyone else is watching it on a different day. There's no common experience, right? Mm-hmm. And we know, I mean, same thing with news, right? People used to sit down and my parents watched, you know, the 6 o'clock news every night, right? And there were three channels, right? So you're pretty much going to get, you know, one source of the truth. And I think oddly that had a powerful connecting effect versus, you know, what millions of channels and the ease with which different disinformation can go through the internet versus, you know, a federally regulated channel, which, you know, people need to understand, right? Like television as a medium was regulated by the federal government. You couldn't mm-hmm. curse, you couldn't lie, right? There were rules to advertising. None of those rules apply online. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason we are where we are.
So leave us with a little bit of hope. What can we do to have a positive impact, not only on our own families, but maybe on our communities too?
Yeah, I think the first thing I will say is that the brain is constantly changing. And so we can always change our brain, and that could be for positive or for negative. So if we get into trouble, there are interventions, there are ways in which we can get back on track. It's always better to prevent problems than to solve them, of course. But, you know, the two things in neurobiology are neurogenesis. We're actually making new neurons all the time. We need to nurture those new neurons in order to make them effective. And neuroplasticity. We can change the connectivity in our brain to reorient ourselves towards healthy, positive behaviors. So hope number one, our brains can change. Hope number two is that, you know, as a species, we have dealt with major technology transformations in the past and somehow managed to survive. So we will survive this as well. The question isn't whether we will survive. I think the question is, will we thrive? And the ability to thrive really comes from being more proactive than reactive, having conversations like this. Thank you very much. You know, spreading the word and getting people to act at every level. You know, whether it's, again, teachers, educators, parents, we got to get, you know, politicians and governments involved. And I'm kind of hopeful, actually, that this whole ChatGPT large language model movement is so powerful and has the potential to change so many things that it may actually focus our collective minds to think about technology in a fundamentally different way that will be more positive.
Well, thank you so much. I've learned so much from you. I appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation today. This has been Simple Families, episode 349. That's simplefamilies.com/episode349. As always, thanks for tuning in. I'm glad you're here.